Good morning again. And for those of you who normally aren't with us here at Calvary Baptist Church, maybe you're visiting for the first time or you're just here for the weekend for the holiday, welcome to this space. I've already wept this morning. So here we are, deeply moved by your prayer, dear friend Will, as you claim and invoke God to continue to craft in this space a safe space, a space that imagines, even this weekend, perhaps, not perhaps, deeply differently from the imagination that we saw, not really on full display, thanks to the weather, but on display this week. So I hope you feel that power this morning. So for those of you, again, who weren't with us last week, we are kind of switching things around a little during the sermon portion for our Summer Unplugged series. And spending some time in what we're calling, it's not really a particularly unique term, but sermon conversations or sermon dialogue. So as you can see, here we are about to dialogue. And what we've invited some folks to do over the course of this series is to do some really challenging, thanks, by the way, challenging and vulnerable work to share some of their origin stories as we both imagine and continue to learn more about our communities, Calvary's origin story, and also are deeply invested as a congregation in understanding our nation's origin story and how that affects our imagination. It takes us understanding particular origin stories too, right? Like your story, my story, each of our stories matter in context as we talk about these bigger stories too. So last week, Pastor Elijah held this sermon conversation with, if you were here last week, with Brooke Davis, based on this story from Genesis about Joseph, which we just sang about, we just read about, and so now we're going to talk briefly about and then enter your story, Diana. So particularly, there's a line, if you caught it, in verse 19, where Joseph's brothers say to him, "Here comes the dreamer," as you heard Kelly read, before they have him enslaved and send him off to die. They're going to have a conversation about, and so Pastor Elijah and Brooke had this conversation in light of this phrase, right, "Here comes the dreamer," about what it's like to work through one's vocational dreams, to work through what we feel called to in life, particularly our commitments to justice and love in the world, while we often work for or work inside of systems and institutions that can feel, shall we say, less than open to those dreams, perhaps even mock us for those dreams. Here comes the dreamer again, right? So this week we're going to continue with this line from Joseph's brothers as our guide. And like I said, that line is kind of part mockery, but it's part truth-telling, and it's part poetry. So it's intersecting in many ways. Here comes the dreamer. I think that your life, Diana, as we unpack it a bit more this morning, is all those things too. Truth-telling, poetry, and in many ways is also problematically judged. As you claim a country of origin here in the U.S., even as we find itself struggling to claim you. So Joseph is this complicated intersectional character in many ways. So he ends up in Egypt later on in his story, right? He's enslaved. He has a whole situation, a whole lot of things happen to him, and he ends up in Egypt. But he's not really of Egypt, but he kind of is of Egypt by the time we get to him later in life. But is he? What is he of? He's an ancient Hebrew. He's multicultural. He's making sense of various worlds of faith. He's struggling to avoid being detained by an empire that later celebrates him so long as he can prove his value to them. he ends up carrying lots of responsibility for his family system, right? Like, he saves and supports them, if you will, at the end. He's an intersectional person with a lot going on. And so are you. When we got together to think through this conversation, that's kind of where we started, I feel like. What came up, I feel like, early on in our conversation were these intersections that reside inside of you and identify you, and you're pushing and pulling and learning from them. And so even this morning as we were getting together and I was joking about, not joking, I was genuinely asking you, I told you, you know, sometimes I'm Maria and sometimes I'm Maria, and it depends on the room I'm in, you know. Like, do you want to be Diana today? Do you want to be Diana today? And we talked about you being Diana Paula Pliego Padilla, right? And what it means, like, the power of that. So Diana, Diana Paula Pliego Padilla. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how your life sits inside these intersections. And again, thank you.
I guess, first of all, thank you for opening a space for these kinds of conversations, and for allowing me to be a little nervous up here. I think definitely when we first started talking, it was divine timing that you reached out at this time, because these are things that I've been thinking about and have been heavily on my mind. But when we talk about this question of, you know, intersectionality, I think I talk about it for work, and I know it, and I know that I'm an intersexual person, but I think growing up, regardless of, like, knowing that, I always still I feel like my life comprised of three different parts, right? There was my immigration experience as an undocumented immigrant in particular. There was my faith, which has always been such a key part of who I am. I've always been involved in church, always loved God. And then my education that would lead to a vocation, a career, right? And I think I've always kind of tried to keep them that way. But it wasn't until college that I learned that I could actually make a career out of, like, fighting for my rights as an undocumented immigrant, fighting for my community. My mind was blown. And then when I came to DC, it was burst again when I realized that there's a whole group of people of faith who are also working to do justice and do good work and to work for my community and with us and walk alongside us. And so, de esa manera, yo crecí creyendo que mi vida como inmigrante, que mi fe y que mi educación y mi carrera eran tres diferentes partes. No fue hasta más adelante en mi carrera que vi que podrían ser una cosa. So grew up thinking that really my faith, the only way it could intersect with my vocation was if I did ministry, right? And I did that, like, in the very traditional sense, thinking that it was set up to do kind of, like, you know, win souls. That's, like, what I was taught growing up. And it took me a really long time to understand that what I do for my community, whether it be through organizing or policy work, or even if it's just even being there and building a community with my friends and being there for each other emotionally and spiritually, that all of that was part of my ministry and my calling. And so even though I always separated my vocational calling from my ministry calling, I think looking back, especially where I'm sitting now, it's clear to see that the clearest calling was always my vocational calling. And it wasn't until, like, more recently that I was able to see that maybe that is my ministry calling as well.
So para mí eso es muy impactante, ¿verdad? Este cambio que has tenido sobre qué significa el ministerio, ¿verdad? ¿Qué es la definición de eso, verdad? So, like, for me, that's really powerful, right? That you have, in doing the work that you've been doing, it sounds to me, I think what I'm hearing is that your understanding of ministry, tu entendimiento del ministerio ha transformado, it's changed, it's evolved over time. Inquiring minds want to know, right? Like, how does that happen? I mean, what's some of the story there that helps you make this deep and abiding connection with what you're up to now, and seeing that as, like, this is like my faith at work?
Yeah, I think my change in how I viewed ministry definitely is 100% tied to my change in how I view my faith. And that has been a long journey. Para mí, definitivamente, la forma en que cambié ver qué es ministerio tiene que ver mucho con el cambio en que cómo he vivido, cómo es que interpreto qué es mi fe. You know, cuando yo crecí, lo que me dijeron mis padres y todas las iglesias que iba es que tener fe era ser puro, ser moral. Era algo muy diferente y no tenía mucho que ver con hacer cosas buenas para tus vecinos. So, being a Christian was really, as I was taught, was to set yourself apart, but from almost purely a purity standpoint, and that was really very much equated to morality. And then the good works in action, right? That was almost like a side piece. Like, as long as you are one righteous being, you may do good things, and that's how people will see you as a Christian. But that's not the main piece. The main piece is just how can you be as pure as possible according to a certain set of standards. And it took me a real long time to see that ministry was so much more than that, and that that's not what Christ really came here to do. And that if you look at what he does. It's all about, like, how do we interact with one another in community? And so it took me a long time to really be able to see, like, the hypocrisy and lack of compassion was what was actually turning people away. But once I got there, I just started to realize, like, if we start with how we treat others, then we can call them into discipleship, into really getting them to want to know God, because God wants to know them, right? So I grew up in a very different space than Calvary. I grew up in that evangelical Pentecostal kind of world. And to me, I remember, you know, Acts, for example, the book where they named that the people called Christians, the other world, the external folks who weren't part of that community named us Christians because of the way that the church lived out their lives, the way they cared for one another, made sure there was no needy among them. Like, that's how they got their name. But for me, Acts was always speaking in tongues and the supernatural, being set free from, like, prisons in supernatural ways. But I think as I'm, you know, living out my life now, I'm starting to see that it's really about both. It's about how you live in community, and it's also about those things. Because for me personally, I can never separate it from that beginning that I had. In the 10th grade, I had a healing where I haven't had to wear glasses since. That's something that's very personal to me. And that same time, I had that person prophesy over my life saying that I would, be a leader among the youth. And I always figured that meant youth ministry. And it wasn't until, like, looking back now, hindsight, I'm looking back into my college years where I organized with immigrant youth across the state of South Carolina. And that was a big deal at the time because there wasn't that kind of infrastructure. And the number of people who came out and were like, I thought I was the only one living like this in this state. Now I can see that as that was my ministry and the way that I was able to impact lives. But it wasn't clear at the time that that's what I was doing.
Yeah. So I remember you describing this moment with this person offering this word to you when you were in high school, que vas a ser una tremenda líder de jóvenes, right? Like, you're going to be this incredible leader for youth. And, like, what does it mean for even a stream of that prophetic imagination to still be, like, entering now the river of your whole life, right? And to still, is I think what I'm hearing you say, right? That it even in its not fullness, it was still, like, this word that was pressing you forward. And now, upon reflection, you're like,
I thought, yeah, I wasn't living it out. I thought that I was like, maybe one day, like, maybe I need to get through this and set up my career, and then I'll be able to have time for ministry. But now I'm like, I've been doing it all along. Like, this was my calling. And every time that I felt like a path was laid before me and God opened a door, it was so clear that God was opening doors because that was my calling.
Y'all, that's good stuff. y'all taking notes? Okay. Amen. So now estás conectando la obra, el trabajo, lo que estás haciendo durante el día, y también entendiendo qué es ministerio. So now you find yourself able to, like, connect this work and vocation and ministry, and looking back on it and saying, wow, this has been ministry all along. But I think there's a story there too about why you can look back now and call that ministry. It's not just any old work, right? It's not just any old thing that you're up to, right? And so in our conversation earlier, as we were preparing, a story that was, it just really struck me, was so moving to me, was these in recent weeks, Theology on Draft has been reading James Cone's memoir on kind of his origin story about how he came to be an origin. I don't think he'd say he's the origin, but a really important origin to Black liberation theology in America and now the world. And that has impacted and affected all kinds of liberation theology across the globe. And so you told this story, and I'm going to ask you to tell us this story about engaging James Cone's work and Black liberation theology became this clarity moment for you about why your work is ministry. Can you please share that?
Yeah, let's recount the time where I bust out crying in TOD. Got very emotional. I said the joke was that because you weren't there, someone else had to cry. So I was just, you passed on the baton.
I'm not going to argue that.
I didn't say that. I don't remember who said that, but no, but I remember
it
was
crying right now. Watch
it. I saw you earlier and I was about to. No, it happened actually. We were reading the very first chapter of basically his origin story and how he came to really think about like his theology. And I just identified so much with every single paragraph we were reading. And in that first chapter, he, you know, made the argument that Black power is the gospel of Jesus in America in that time. In a similar way that I have kind of felt that like immigrant rights is like the civil rights issue of our day. And that, I mean, you can just see it, just how it's just talked about and like with the issues that we're having at our border and so many other things. But the part that really struck me and the part that made me cry was when he got to the point where he, in his journey, realized, you know, he had this idea and he identified so strongly with the cross and like Jesus, and that's why he understood it as like his struggle. And he was trying to convey that to the world, but they didn't quite understand it, and they thought he was crazy. But he said he had to get to a point where he stopped seeking validation from white theologians. And he understood that he as a Black person had the authority and power to speak truth because he identified with it. And so he used his experience as a base for theological reflection. And that was just huge for me because I think, you know, from my experience in the immigrant community, at least the spaces that I went to in churches, and I went to many churches growing up, we were honestly basically taught like this white evangelism and conservative culture that you see here in America today. And so they didn't talk about these like social justice issues. If they talked about immigration, it was like, let me pray for you in your specific situation. There was no action to pair with that to get something done on behalf of the community. And so I think it's always been like, oh, well, like we stand with you in your struggle, but no one was willing to name the action of coming here, however that might be, it was a righteous thing. And so it just like hit me that I needed to stop doing that, and that my story, like knowing that my parents' story, knowing that they didn't make the move without lots of prayer, and they didn't make the final decision to come until they firmly believed that God put a stamp of approval on us coming, and that He would keep us safe, and that we would be here, and that this is where we were meant to be. And so I've just since then just given the thought, like I've always, you know, the slogan is like migration is beautiful, but I think it's not just beautiful. It's not just a right. It's a righteous thing for many people. We have to stop seeking validation from our oppressors. They're never going to give it to us, and it's not theirs to give. It's from God. And I think at the root of it is, for me, is, you know, when God tells us that He is for us, and He is for all of us. And the same God that, like, the white Trump supporting people are praying to for whatever they think is America needs is the same God that I'm praying to, that millions of other undocumented immigrants are praying for, the same God that the kids at the border are praying to, the same God that the Palestinian girl seeking safety is praying for, that the queer teenager feeling outcasted is praying to. And if he is for each and every one of us, then our theology needs to be based on that. And if it's not, then we need to reevaluate that. And I would also say our politics, especially if you claim to have them be rooted in the Christian faith. Don't hijack my faith or my God to serve your agenda of hatred.
Do I get to start crying now?
Go ahead.
We even practiced this, y'all. And I still feel like it's fresh. Can you say more? ¿Puedes decir un poco más sobre el significado para ti de ahora entender que el viaje, la decisión que tus padres tomó era uno que fue justo y bueno y sano, y no solamente lo tolerable o lo que tenía que pasar, right? So, like, could you say a little bit more about this discovery you've had, and it sounds like relatively recently, this kind of theological one-ish.
Yeah.
Okay. That, like, your parents' choice to make this dangerous, uncertain journey to the U.S. isn't just the thing that had to be done or a thing that happened or one relatively bad decision in the midst of others, but, like, was actually a moral, just, and good one for the sake of their lives and their family. And I think that's so powerful, and I'm wondering if you could tell us more.
Yeah, and I will say, you'd think I would have come to that conclusion sooner, because I always knew the story. I knew that my parents came against literally everybody else's wishes, including their pastor, who they admired deeply. My grandpa from my mom's side told her, I mean, she came by herself. My dad was here for a year before. My mom came by herself with a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 7-month-old. Everyone told her we were going to die, basically. My grandpa from my mom's side, he told her, like, leave the baby with me. Like, I will raise him here. But separation was not an option. And I knew, and I've always known, that the reason that my youngest brother is a favorite, he's the one who was born here, is because he was basically the answer to my mom's prayer. And there's a Bible verse that she points to, and she's like, this was the confirmation that I needed to make the move. And I understood half of it before making the move, and the other half became answered when he was born. So I've always known that they did pray about it. And I talk about it at work as knowing that it wasn't a wrong thing, but there's something about having this instilled for me within you from different institutions your entire life that you just internalize. Even the narrative that you're constantly fighting. So I could be speaking with my mouth, but I don't think I fully believed it, frankly, until reading James Cone, which is why prompted that emotional breakdown. It was something just hit me about, like, my experience is valid. And knowing that my parents didn't make that move without it being guided from God, like, I knew that, but it didn't hit me until I saw someone else that also made that theological assertion from their experience. Entonces, siempre lo supe. Lo supe que era algo de Dios que vinimos, pero como que tomó años y años de pelear contra todo lo la basura.
Amén.
Que el mundo nos ha dicho de lo que nosotros hicimos, de lo que mis padres hicieron fue malo. Y no fue hasta que vi y me identifiqué con James Cone que su experiencia era válida y fue aprobada por Dios. Fue hasta que lo vi en alguien más que pude identificar que yo no había quebrado esas barreras.
So, en medio de todo esto, de descubrir y entender, ¿verdad? De verdad internalizar esto. Si te pregunto esto, Diana, ¿quién eres? ¿Qué sientes cuando pregunto esto? So in the midst of all this, like, rediscovering and exploring, like, if I ask you the question, you don't have to necessarily answer who you are, but, like, if I ask you the question, Diana, who are you? Like, what comes up for you? What do you feel when facing a question like that?
Siempre he respondido esa pregunta dependiendo de dónde estoy. I've always answered that "how, who are you" question just based on where I'm at. Again, because I silo my life. So if you ask me in a happy hour with friends, it's probably going to my job. But one thing that, it, this may be silly, but my Twitter bio, I took a long time to come up with something for it because I wanted it to be all-encompassing.
I didn't even have one. I don't know how to do
it. But I took a long time to, like, come up with it because I wanted it to truly be a reflection of who I was, for some reason, even though I'm never on there. And so it says, if you go to it, it says, dreamer, fighter, overcomer, follower of Christ, seeker of justice. And so I think a lot of times people, they know me as, like, you know, like a DACA recipient or a dreamer. But I want to make sure that at least now, like, where I'm coming to is that I'm not selling myself off. Like, I think I used to think of myself as, like, having layers, and now I truly understand that, like, I cannot separate who I am. So it's hard to answer that question because I'm still formulating what that means. But when I think of, like, existential questions that I ponder about on a daily basis, I don't think of them from, oh, what is my, like, job thing? Would have me think about this. I don't think about them as, like, what is my faith? I think about them from all the angles and perspectives at once. And so, you know, my, as I think about, like, my roots being Pentecostal, I want to disregard the bad and what was harmful, but I want to take the good. My dad always said, toma lo bueno, desecha lo malo. Like, that was always his thing.
What does that mean in English?
It means take the good and leave the bad. And so that's what I want to do, even with my roots, even though they're responsible for bringing me here. There was good in them, obviously. But I want to be able to not just focus on the miraculous and the individual, but also to focus on what is blocking us from living our best lives here on this earth. And how do we live in community with one another? Because I do think that, like, God is a God of both. And so, in the same way that I feel like God is, like, a God of all things, like, I'm also of all things, because he made me that way.
So your Twitter bio starts with you saying that you are a dreamer. And as we also sit with a dreamer, Joseph, and try to make sense of his intersections and also listen deeply to yours, what does it mean to you to be a dreamer?
You know, dreamer is funny because it's a very problematic term now in the immigration movement. some people hate it now. I still use it just because I feel like people just understand automatically. It's a well-known term, so if I say it, people will typically know. And I will say that there was good to it in the sense that it brought us this far. The fact that people know who dreamers are, relatively know most of our stories-ish, you know, it's allowed us to get to where we are. But the problem with it is that if you think of dreamer, what do you think of? You typically think of students, valedictorians, overachievers, someone who is deserving. And that automatically sets up this, like, other class of people who is maybe not so deserving because they didn't get straight A's. They got to be in there somewhere. They don't deserve to go to college. And so when we do that, especially through really problematic things like they came here through no fault of their own. Well, whose fault was that? And you're setting ourselves up for people blaming our parents as they did the wrong thing. They should be punished. Their kids are fine, but they did the wrong thing, even though I firmly believe that if you admire me in any way, shape, or form, then you're admiring the work of my parents. I would not be where I am, who I am, without them and my community as a whole. That's where I get my strength from. So if you admire me at all, like, it has to come from them. And so it's really problematic because it's gained us access to these new places. But, I think with that, like, favoritism, like, for me, at least, it comes with a lot of responsibility. Because we have to, like, reach back and bring others as we are trying to kick down these doors. And we have to, while we benefit from being, like, that soft spot of America, like, we have to bring everybody else with us. We can't just let our parents do the hard work of getting us here and then leave them behind. So,
and we talked some about the pressure involved in that for you, right? Like the daily realities faced as a result of that, like thinking about future for yourself, for your parents, for your family system, like kind of trying to hold all these threads together all at once. So to me, that becomes an act of participation on our part as a community, right? How do we hold those threads together with you? Do we understand them deeply enough? Have we asked enough questions to understand what it is that's being held day to day? So I'm going to claim it as an invitation to us. What's your dream, dreamer? What is your dream?
Also given a lot of thought to this recently. I feel like it's hard to conceptualize. There's no specifics, but it really is just for my family, and for my family to be free. And if my family is free, then I know that other families are free. But I mean truly free. I mean being able to not just go on a vacation and forget about your troubles and then come back to them. I mean not having every single obstacle and wall in the way that can be humanly contrived. Like not being afraid of the people who are supposed to protect you, of the police, not being afraid of going out and driving to work, not having fear constantly be in the back of your mind. If we have fear in the back of our mind, then we are not free. Which is another part that, you know, struck me when reading James Cone. He talked about how during the civil rights movement, people would basically prepare their will ahead of time just in case something happened, which is not surprising, right? But I just think about that even within immigrant rights spaces, part of Know Your Rights is to have a plan and to have like a power of attorney. That way if something happens, someone can take care of your kids, can have access to your finances. So it's different. It's to a very different scale, but it's very much on that parallel track. And at the end of the day, it's still constantly living in fear and what if. And so my dream is just that they be free.
So again, si Diana es nuestra hermana y su sueño es que su familia será libre, if Diana is our sister and her dream is for her family to be free, guess what that means, beloved community? That's our dream, too. Our dream. Our work, our challenge, our gospel, our daily bread is to imagine together, to grind together, to be together until the kingdom of God is real on earth as it is in heaven. You have held so much this morning, my friend. Thank you for guiding us toward and pressing your origin story into us and alongside us so that we can imagine freedom more deeply. I think about Joseph again and his intersections and what it meant for him to live a life constantly sort of at the edge in between freedom and non-freedom all the time, right? Like there are these moments where everything was good. There are these moments where he's incarcerated. There's these moments where it's falling apart. There's these moments where he gains power because of his value. He's wedging inside the midst of all of this and trying to figure out what freedom looks like. What freedom looks like for himself and what freedom looks like for his family. And so I invite us all this morning, every morning, every day, every night, to be about the work of freedom. Doy gracias a Dios por tu historia, por este momento, por la oportunidad de validar, escuchar y de verdad recibir el contexto y la imaginación que tú nos da hoy por ser discípulos verdaderamente, discípulos de Cristo. It was interesting. Even this morning, we were talking about sort of making sure we were thinking well about words we might use in English or in Spanish, and we were talking about the word righteousness in English, and how if you look in your Spanish Bible, you won't find it, because righteousness is always just translated justicia. I think it has to do with the Latin Vulgate. I don't really know. I tried to trace it one time. But there's a way, right, in which this inhibits us theologically, because righteousness and justice become these separate things for us, right? Righteousness is what I do. Justice is hopefully what the world does. And yet justicia holds it all together, where what we do, what I do, what you do, what we do, all is connected and building the kingdom on earth. Let's stand and sing together. And as we sing, I invite you to treat your singing almost like a blessing to this story and this moment. Gracias, hermana.